Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 20th of June, these are our main stories. Russia condemns a decision by Dutch prosecutors to put three Russians and a Ukrainian on trial for shooting down Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 in 2014. Verdicts are handed down in the cases of four men accused of colluding with others in the 2015 attack on the Garissa University in Kenya. And another round of voting to decide who will be chosen as Britain's next Prime Minister. Also in this podcast, scientists say the rate at which Himalayan glaciers are melting has apparently doubled in recent years.
As the glaciers shrink, their contribution to river flows, seasonal contributions, will be reduced. And so this will affect the water supply for millions of people who live downstream.
And it sold for $180,000. We found out why a rusty revolver made such an impression on the art world. But first, in our podcast yesterday, we brought you the news that four pro-Russian rebel fighters in Ukraine are to be charged with murder over the downing of Malaysia Airlines flight MH17 in 2014, with a loss of nearly 300 lives. A Dutch-led team of investigators said three senior officials in the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic and a unit commander would go on trial in the Netherlands in March, almost certainly in their absence. I asked our Moscow correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, whether any of the accused had responded to the charges.
There's been a very brief comment from one of the main men mentioned, Igor Girkin, who was, back in 2014, was the Minister of Defence of the self-proclaimed Donetsk People's Republic. He's simply given one line of reaction, saying that the rebels were not involved in shooting down MH17. He also said that they had no such weaponry. The Buk anti-aircraft missile system, he said, was not in the hands of the rebels at the time. It comes as the Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, told me that Russia's position on this whole investigation is very well known, and that is that because Russia is not formally involved in the investigation, that essentially Moscow simply doesn't trust its conclusions. It sees the fact that Ukraine is involved in the investigation as making that whole process biased.
So that's their position, Sarah. What about the general position with regards to extraditions from Moscow to other countries?
That's simply not going to happen. I mean, Russia's constitution and Ukraine's constitution, in fact, doesn't allow for extradition of Russian citizens to other countries. And I think, you know, it's highly unlikely, in fact, near to impossible, that any of these men will be handed over, in fact, or in any way cooperate with the inquiry. I think what's interesting from Russia's perspective is the fact that all of those named so far are former military or former intelligence officers with the Russian military or intelligence. They're not acting men in uniform at the moment.
And Sarah, how is this being reported in the media there in Russia?
The reporting here has been fairly limited, and what there has been to say that Russia has destroyed the claims made by the investigation team. Now, as I say, Russia's position has been that because Ukraine's involved, this is a biased process from the start. Russia also had this theory that, in fact, the Buk missile was, in fact, fired from Ukrainian-controlled territory, and it claims that that suggestion was then ignored by the investigation team. So Russia, right up to Mr. Putin all along, has said that its evidence, in fact, are being ignored. And this is therefore a biased process.
That was Sarah Rainsford in Moscow. In Kenya, a judge has passed sentences on four men accused of colluding with others in the 2015 attack on Garissa University. Islamic militants killed 152 people. Dozens of others were injured when the gunmen stormed the university, armed with AK-47 assault rifles and explosive belts. The Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has said it was responsible. Our correspondent Emmanuel Igunza was in court.
He acquitted Sahal Diriyeh Hussein, saying that there was no evidence linking him to any of the gunmen or any of the other suspects. But the three other suspects, Rashid Mberesero, Mohamed Ali Abikar, and Hassan Eddin, were all found guilty. And basically, the prosecution relied on communication that these three men alleged to have had with the gunmen prior to and also during that attack at the University of Garissa. And so they will now be sentenced on July 3rd. Today in court, there were several relatives, and I was just seated next to one. And when the judge was delivering his judgment and going through the testimonies that were given by witnesses, she was in tears. She was constantly crying and holding her head in her hands as she listened to some of the really graphic descriptions of what had happened to the students who died in that attack. For many of them, this will be an opportunity to finally get over this really horrific period of their life. And I've been speaking to one of the survivors, a young woman called Anastasia Mwika.
We were asleep and we were woken by the gunshots. That is, we didn't know where the sounds were coming from. We could hear the shoutings of the other students and the shots from far. We didn't know where to run to, so we just stayed inside. Of it, they came inside and they found us and started shooting at us. I remained wherever I was until I was rescued.
That was Anastasia Mwika, a survivor of the Garissa University attack. She was speaking to Emmanuel Igunza. The US military says one of the oil tankers targeted in the Gulf of Oman last week was damaged by a mine resembling those used by the Iranian security forces. The attack on the Japanese-owned tanker was the second such incident in the strategic shipping lane in a month. The Iranian government has denied any involvement. Today, the US Navy took journalists on a tour of the damaged ship, currently moored off the United Arab Emirates. Our correspondent Mark Lowen was among them.
We travelled for an hour off the coast of the UAE, across choppy waters, through which a fifth of the world's oil passes. As Washington builds its case that Iran was behind last week's tanker attacks here, the US Navy took us to the Kokuka Courageous, one of the two ships targeted.
Well, you can see the force of the blast here. This hole, say the Americans, was an Iranian-placed limpet mine that blew through both the outer and inner hull of this ship. Now, it looks like it was designed, say the Americans, to damage rather than to sink the ship. It could have been a show of strength more than anything else. But either way, it's caused a huge ratcheting up of international tension.
We were shown what the US says are fragments of the mine and a magnet allegedly used by the Iranians to remove an unexploded device. Sean Kido is a commander at the US facility near the port of Fujairah.
The limpet mine that was used in the attack is distinguishable, and it is also strikingly bearing a resemblance to Iranian mines that have already been publicly displayed in Iranian military parades.
Iran, though, continues to deny involvement. Its president, Hassan Rouhani, denounced the US for asking Iran to negotiate while pressuring his country economically. This doesn't seem like a clever move, he said. Taking part in negotiations under pressure is equivalent to an act of surrender. As this standoff intensifies, both sides are calculating how far to push. It's inching a volatile region closer to conflict.
Mark Lowen in the United Arab Emirates. In our earlier podcast, our global health correspondent Tulip Mazumda reported on the level of global trust or mistrust in vaccines and how misinformation online affects the number of people protected. Measles is one of the diseases in question, and the Philippines is currently fighting a major outbreak. Some 500 people have died this year already, and more than 35,000 others, many of them children, have been infected. Tulip went to see the situation for herself in the capital, Manila.
A mother gently fans her limp and exhausted baby on a hot and humid hospital ward. This tiny baby hasn't eaten for several days. Her skin is mottled and sore with red spots. Her lips are chapped and dry. Many of these babies are less than 6 months old, too young to have had the measles vaccine. They have to rely on others around them being immunised so they don't come into contact with the potentially deadly disease.
The spread of the disease was fast. So from just maybe 10 to 15 admissions a night, we were admitting 30 to 40 and even as high as 80 patients admitted every night.
Dr. Ferdinand de Guzman heads up the family medicine department here at Manila's San Lazaro Hospital.
It's a strain not only on us, but of course to the families first. They thought that measles was just a fever rash, and nobody dies from measles, but we were seeing patients dying from measles every day.
In the next ward, two-year-old Princess rests as her grandmother Lola watches over her. I feel so frightened seeing her with this fever, Lola tells me. She looks so different. She goes on to explain that Princess was not immunized. Her family was worried that the vaccine might harm her. Dr. Guzman says he's met many families here who felt the same way.
We were so frustrated, disappointed, because the vaccine for measles is given free at the different health centers. And it's just there waiting for people, waiting for the mothers to have their children immunized. And it could have prevented the outbreak.
Much of these misconceptions center on the controversial rollout of a new dengue vaccine in 2016. 800,000 school children were vaccinated using Dengvaxia. But the manufacturer later disclosed that its product posed a risk to some children. Some families blamed the vaccine for their children's deaths. Investigations are underway, but no link has been proven. Health officials say inaccurate and sensationalist information about vaccines in general spread online, resulting in the confidence in all vaccines plummeting. We've come to Baseco slum. There are around 60,000 people who live here. We're walking through tiny, winding passages, and there are rows and rows of little shacks. We've come to meet 20-year-old Arlin.
Como está, Arlin? Nice to see you.
Arlin clutches onto photos of her children, 2-year-old Jenilyn and 8-month-old John Paul. They both died of measles within a week of each other. Arlin tells me she bitterly regrets not vaccinating her two babies.
I just feel so angry. I shouldn't have listened to the TV and social media. I was afraid, but I should have protected my children.
The Philippines has been described as the social media capital of the world, and fear and misinformation online was able to overtake science and evidence for many parents deciding whether to vaccinate their children. Access to health facilities and complacency among families and even some health workers have also been a key factor here.
It's lamentable. I really feel, you know, almost sick to the core that this had to happen.
That's Philippines Health Secretary Dr. Francisco Duque III.
It's misinformation for the large part lies being peddled around. I think what we have done is really yielding dividends in terms of we're able to win back public confidence, you know, constantly bombarding the public with the correct information with regard to our immunization program.
Families here in the Philippines, though, have paid a high price for the dip in vaccination rates. But health authorities here say confidence in these life-saving vaccines is returning.
Tulip Mazumdar. On Wednesday evening here in London, the outcome of the third round of voting to choose the next leader of the Conservative Party and, as a result, the next British Prime Minister was announced. The choice is now down to four, as our political correspondent Rob Watson explains.
I think there are two big headlines. The first is the obvious one, and that is that Boris Johnson remains way out in head, and I think he has to be, as he is the odds-on favourite to be the next Prime Minister sometime in the last week of July. The other headline is that Rory Stewart has gone. He's the International Development Minister. Why does that matter? Because it now means that the candidates left, the leadership hopefuls remaining, they all have pretty much the same position on Brexit, and that is basically a twofold position. Number one, to try and renegotiate negotiate Theresa May's deal with the European Union, somehow get a better deal, they haven't explained how, and to say, if that doesn't work, that all of them, all the remaining candidates, would prefer a no-deal Brexit, Britain leaving without a deal, to no Brexit at all. And, of course, Rory Stewart had been saying he didn't believe renegotiation was possible, and he also wouldn't leave without a deal. So in many ways, if you like, the race has become a bit less interesting, at least in terms of policy.
And in a word, Rob, does it make a no-deal Brexit more likely?
Yes, definitely.
Rob Watson. Still to come on this podcast, why an American billionaire has made a very generous donation to Oxford University. We hear a lot these days about how global warming is melting ice in the Arctic. But researchers at New York's Columbia University believe the rate at which the Himalayan glaciers are melting has doubled in recent years. And that will have a very significant impact on the environment and on those who live in the region. Our science correspondent Rebecca Morell told me how the scientists use spy satellites as part of their research.
Yeah, it's really unusual, actually. So this was an American program of Cold War spy satellites, 20 reconnaissance satellites up in space, snapping pictures of the Earth. These images were declassified in 2011. And scientists thought, well, hang on, we might be able to use them because the Himalayas is an area where there's very scarce data during this period. So actually, they were able to take these images taken by the spy satellites and compare them with modern day satellites. And through that, they were able to see how the region had changed. And what they found was this absolutely massive melt of the glaciers. They found that the glaciers are melting in height. They're losing about half a metre every year. That's double the rate in kind of between 2000 and 2016 to the latter bit of the last century. And they're losing 8 billion tonnes of water each year. That's the equivalent of 3.2 million Olympic-sized swimming pools. So, I mean, it's a really dramatic change.
Huge amounts. I mean, and this matters because these glaciers fill the rivers, the Brahmaputra and the Ganges, and that in turn gives water to many millions of people.
Yeah, I mean, there's a double whammy, really, because first of all, you've got all of this meltwater building up. So first of all, you've got the flood risk. There's lots of extra water in the system. But secondly, it's the water loss, which is a real issue, as Dr. Josh Maurer from Columbia University, who led the research, explains.
As the glaciers shrink, their contribution to river flows, seasonal contributions, will be reduced. And so this will affect the water supply for millions of people who live downstream. More arid regions, especially because during times when the monsoon is not active, the glaciers supply a significant portion of the water.
So, Rebecca, do we know what's causing this? Is it as simple as just saying it's global warming?
Well, there has been a bit of wrangling over it. Some scientists thought maybe it's kind of changes in precipitation in the area. Others thought it was maybe soot, so black carbon from industrial pollution, which causes the ice to melt faster. But the overarching cause, as the scientists here found, was warming temperatures. That's really what's driving the melt across this large, large area. And the problem is, even with really radical changes, it's going to be hard to stop this melt now it's started.
Our science correspondent, Rebecca Morell, there. One of the leading universities here in Britain, Oxford University, has been given its biggest donation in modern times. The gift was made by an American billionaire, as Terry Egan explains.
This is $180 million. It's one of the largest donations in the university's history. It's by Stephen Schwartzman, and he's the chief executive of the US investment firm Blackstone. And there'll be a centre named after him, and that's to house all of the university's humanities subjects in one place. A new library, space for exhibitions, a 500-seat concert hall. But more importantly, it'll also be the home of the university's Institute for Ethics and AI, Artificial Intelligence, exploring how AI will be used in society and the workplace. Now, Mr. Schwartzman says this is a major issue of our times. It's a new revolution involving robotics and computer science innovations, but that it has to be introduced in the right way.
The scientists now agree that they want AI introduced in an ethical way because they don't want to experience the downsides for society that they had with the internet. And so I think this is like one of the major issues of our age. It's important for people to remember what being human is.
Now, those downsides include cyberbullying, lack of freedom of speech, advertising, and he thinks the government is not prepared for what this AI revolution will really mean. And last year, he gave MIT $350 million, that's the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and that was to fund a new college for computing and artificial intelligence. The bigger question really is how good a university is, of course, and wealth is not necessarily the main factor. There are others, location, facilities, but it is certainly a huge one. The richer it is, the more up-to-date technology is available and opportunities for research. So many universities considered the richest are also understandably considered to be the best. And on that score, you have universities like Harvard in Massachusetts, Yale in Connecticut, and MIT, as I mentioned. In 2015, an alumnus of Harvard, John A. Paulson, donated $400 million to its School of Applied Sciences. That made it the largest single donor in university history. And Yale got $250 million from Charles B. Johnson, the chairman of Franklin Resources. So Oxford, for all its high profile, is still up against some stiff competition. It's a busy marketplace, but this donation can certainly help, and it's great publicity.
That was Terry Egan. Football is rapidly gaining popularity in Mauritania. This month, the country in West Africa will rally behind its national team, the Mourabitoun, as they compete in their first Africa Cup of Nations. Their qualification is the result of several years of hard work by the players and the federation, who've been steadily developing the game there. Babacar Diarra of BBC Sport Africa went to meet the team at their training ground.
Mauritania may not yet be a major name in African football, but they are making an impact, already scooping up 2019's African National Team of the Year award from the Confederation of African Football. Ibrahima Koulibaly is the team's midfielder.
I was happy and at the same time proud, especially for my parents. It's a great source of pride for the family and for everybody. To represent Mauritania, it's something huge.
The national squad is made up of both Mourabitouns and dual nationals. The number of expatriates on the team has tripled since 2014, which is when Mauritania's head coach, Corentin Martins, joined the side.
Some of these players didn't need to be convinced. They wanted to be part of the national team, which has been doing great things lately. I never talk about a mix of expats with locals. They will wear the Mauritania jersey, so they are Mauritanians.
Back in 2012, Mauritania was ranked 206th by FIFA. Now they are knocking on the door of the top 100 as they gear up to play their first Africa Cup of Nations. Midfielder Adama Ba says that the team has come a long way.
It's not a matter of individuals. We are a team that has grown over the past 4 years. It's about trying to stay together and get good results during the AFCON, God willing.
The team is passionate, both about the game and about patriotically representing their country. Here is team forward Suleiman Han.
The nation, the country calls you. You can't refuse. It's the country.
The country's love of football has also helped promote women's football. In 2016, women's leagues were open to resounding public support. The football scene has changed a great deal since then, with many more female spectators filling seats. Former player and current coach Abdoulaye Diallo has witnessed the change.
Today, women like everybody are involved. Everybody is at the stadium. Even when we train during Ramadan, women come to attend training.
Mauritania is one of three countries that are playing in the AFCON tournament for the first time. The team has high hopes for the tournament and hope to be a continual source of national pride.
That was Babacar Diarra in Mauritania. The gun with which Vincent van Gogh is believed to have killed himself has been sold at auction for about $180,000. But the sale of the rusty revolver has sparked controversy and reignited a debate about the Dutch painter's death. Our Paris correspondent Lucy Williamson explains.
It wasn't the prettiest object to have graced an auction. The star of today's sale, carefully mounted and lit by the Drouot auction house in Paris, was the rusted skeleton of a pistol, fossilised with age. The gun, unearthed by a farmer from a field north of Paris, is considered by many experts to be the weapon Vincent van Gogh used to kill himself more than a century ago, shooting himself in the chest one July Sunday behind a village church in Auvers-sur-Oise. The location where the gun was found and its age, calibre and firepower all match the one van Gogh would have used, experts say, though American researchers have since queried the tale of suicide, saying that two young boys were playing with a gun nearby and were responsible for shooting the artist when they pressed the trigger by mistake. Either way, the lurid aura of this story was enough to almost treble predictions for today's bid, with the gun's anonymous buyer parting with more than €160,000 for a hunk of rusting metal, billed as the most famous weapon in the history of art.
That report from our Paris correspondent, Lucy Williamson. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles. Until next time, goodbye.